The title of my broadcast is World Watchers, and it's program number 770. Before it begins, we want to thank Uncle Gaylord's Ice Cream Cafe for the patron grant. They're open at 7 a.m. till 11 p.m. at the Doubletree Mall in Monterey, serving old-fashioned ice creams, fruit ices, and more. For the underwriting grant that brings us the following, or brings you the following hour of World Watchers, we thank you very much. I went there this weekend to see how it was, and it's very good. Delicious. Okay. Now, the broadcast is number 770, and this is September the 8th, 1986. The subject came up this last weekend and in correspondence and conversation through the years about my pronunciation of proper names. And some of you probably wonder why I'm not so particular about it. And the honest truth is that I don't really give a bean about whether I pronounce these names right or not. I'm an existentialist. I don't think it's important. It's kind of an irreverence for these people that I'm talking about, particular killers and genocide artists. Totally crazy people, most of them. I don't purposely mispronounce them, but I really don't care. And my philosophy is based upon people that I like and particularly enjoy their free-flowing style. Artists such as Samuel Beckett, Jean-Paul Sartre, particularly Beckett, and Ionesco, and the existential writers. They say what they want. They don't spend time putting commas. They repeat words. I think of Gertrude Stein is one of my favorites, and James Joyce, and they're told you can't run words together. You need a period at the end of a sentence, and poetry has to rhyme. In the same way when artists went out to paint, the new artists, beginning with people like Picasso and Moreau, or even going back to Van Gogh, they have their own traditions and move on and really do not care. I'm not so insecure that my credibility depends upon whether I say their names or not. I refer to Licio Gelli, a member of Hitler's Gestapo, the SS. He was part of the planning of the Bologna bombing, where so many people were killed, about 80 people. He set up the P2 Masonic Lodge and built the rat line for Nazis to escape to start World War III and move down to South America and begin all over again. People will say, you know, his name is Licio Gelli. Well, I call him Licio Gelli. He's lucky that's all I call him. And sometimes I give people different names, like Evil Younger, who used to be the Attorney General of the state. I call him Evil Younger. I don't change the names often, but the pronunciation is the very last thing I've ever been concerned with. And if you've seen any of the plays of the existentials, almost all of them, if there happens to be a clock on the stage, the clock is faced against the wall, and the back of the clock is where the audience sees it, or they often have a clock without hands. And the reason they do that is that time doesn't matter. If a couple is on the stage or two people arguing and fighting, if you see a clock, you'll think it's 12 o'clock, maybe they're tired or whatever. Time has no meaning to some of these playwrights. I remember when Dave Buffet was making paintings of chicken feces on some bare wrapping of potato sacks and cloths, and members of my family and people made fun of his paintings, and they went on to be worth 20, 30, 40,000 and more, and they're in every museum of modern art. I think of my particular work as an art form. Now, I'm very particular about the accuracy of what I say, where I get my sources, that the material is timely and that it is important to our future and it pertains to how we got there by the machinations of people in the past. And outside of that, you can say Nicaragua, you can say Nicaragua, whatever you want. I just say the quickest thing that comes to my mind because, as I say, it may be important to some people. When I was growing up, it was important that you never wore white shoes after September the 1st or you look tacky. Those things I have outgrown. I don't think about them. I'm thinking about what I'm trying to say that is important, and I'll leave the pronunciation to you. So if you're worrying that I made a mistake about it, the truth is I just say it as I think it, and I really don't care at all. As I say, you can put the periods and the commas, and I'll do the research, and this way we can all help each other. Now, there's so much news this past week. It's just accumulating. It's impossible to go through it, and I do want to continue on Cameroon 2, the belief that I have that it was a neutron bomb that was dropped in Africa. So I'm going to put off a lot of stories. There's important stories on Star Wars. There's the story of Danilov, the spy. Was he a spy writing for U.S. News Report? Asking that question of a reporter in the Soviet Union is like asking if Aristotle Onassis ever cheated on his wives. The important thing is, was Danilov a provocateur? Remember the peace conference and meeting that Khrushchev was going to have with President Eisenhower, and he told the military, don't fly any of the U-2s. So they were purposely flown, and Gary Powers was down to break up the peace talk. Ronald Reagan and the National Security Council don't want any peace talks. If Mr. Danilov was passing documents to a spy, do you think he'd do it in an open place where people could see them, exchange them with their hands? I mean, if you do it in the open, in the public, you want to be caught. And being tried and convicted doesn't mean anything. Gary Powers was tried and convicted, and so what? He'll come home in a few years if it's a trial, and he'll write a book and make $1 million, and he knows it. So it doesn't really matter. If he's meeting a friend, if he's leaving the Soviet Union and it's a long friend he had, you don't bring a package to your friend who's going home and endanger him. You go to his home, or he goes to your home if it's a friend, or in the embassy or in the bathroom where the CIA do their exchanging of notes. And if it's not a friend, spies aren't that open about, they still find places of eating or putting something on the bench of a table. I've read enough books that it's so obvious to stand there and hand something to somebody. I think he's setting up another anti-Soviet shtick that will go on and on. I'm going to do more update on advanced genetic sciences. They got the go-ahead for Frostband with Mr. Graham going from the shuttle program at NASA to the White House, and Mr. Bogorod from Harvard to the White House, and the team working together. There will be no stopping, even if the genetic altered bacteria shows up years later. Last week, I thought it was a victory. This week, yeah, you can go ahead and do it. I'm not going to talk about the Pakistan hijacking. I have a lot of reasons for believing it took place. And Mr. Zia will quickly hang the people. We shot Lee Harvey Oswald in the Dallas jail. Those four will be hung and justice will be served. And Zia will give Ronald Reagan something to campaign about, because if he loses the elections for the House and Senate, particularly in the Senate elections in 1968, then his next 2 years will be a disaster. I'm not going to talk. I'm going at length more on the synagogue shooting in Turkey and the use of that for Ronald Reagan for election purposes, whipping up the terrorism, getting the Jewish support, just as he got the black support for sending American troops into Bolivia because of his drug campaign, beginning 1 week before Len Bias and Don Rogers were killed. There's a lot of interesting material on their deaths. And as I say, there's so much coming in. And on the controversial discussion in Paris about the AIDS disease possibly being carried by mosquitoes and insects and breaking open a whole new layer of AIDS. And then there's an article, and I've known this for a few weeks, the Duke and Duchess of Windsor left a will. When the Duchess died, all of their money goes to the Pasteur Clinic in Paris, the first hospital that identified the disease AIDS. And they don't, I don't know how much they have, but these were people very close to Rudolf Hess and Hermann Goering and the entire Nazi group. And now anything they had goes right to Pasteur Clinic, the discoverer of AIDS. There's one little story I'll tell you real fast because it's not a long one. We'll slip it in. I read that Hitler's three-piece silver tea set was sold this week for $13,000. I guess he's not going to be a yuppie anymore. It went for $13,000, Hitler having tea at the Eagle's Nest. And also Rudolf Hess, you might have seen in the paper this week, the last Nazi war criminal at Spandau, was only allowed to see two TV shows, Dynasty and Dallas, and then he keeps diaries and writes them for 3 weeks. The guard takes them out, brings them new diaries, they burn the old ones, and he starts writing new ones. If this isn't a crazy world, well, it is, and how can you explain all these phenomena? Also, there was a movie on home box office about Yuri Nosenko, the KGB agent, and the possible links or linkage with Lee Harvey Oswald. And I want to do a lot more on that broadcast. There were just so many things about subliminal. And there's a shot of just they briefly mentioned that Martin Luther King had been killed that had nothing to do with the plot. About 10 minutes later, there was a shot of Detroit, a city burning on fire. And then they started to play Summertime from Porgy and Bess. See the fire, hear the music, think of black people and riots. There was a lot of subliminal going through that. I taped it. And I'm going to play the soundtrack back and look at the text. It just was an amazing piece of hogwash. You can't even call it propaganda. It wouldn't serve any purposes. It was so, so bad. But it's interesting what the system keeps putting out without much cost. The cost goes into the advertising of the schlock. So We'll pass that on. Now, there's one quick story not to do with Cameroon, but maybe not separate from it. And it's been in the news the last few weeks, and I totally don't understand it. Maybe you people, sometimes when I don't understand something, you call me and tell me what you see in it. There's a doctor, Martin Spector from Philadelphia, who's been sending parts of bodies by way of United Parcel to a research center in Denver, Colorado. And by mistake, some heads, 25 human heads, and five arms were sent to Louisville, Kentucky. And they went, opened it up and carried it on, weren't refrigerated, I guess, and sent to the Colorado Autologic Research Center in Denver. This is in Colorado. Now, the FBI spokesman said, in quotes, "We don't see any federal violation leap out at us. Nothing wrong. There's no federal violation with sending 25 heads and five arms to Colorado from a doctor in Philadelphia." And it's been going on that he's been sending body parts and heads for 15 years. And then at the bottom of the article says, Spector told investigators that he shipped body parts to medical research centers for 15 years, but he has refused to tell police where he obtained them. Well, what are the police for? What are the FBI for? Maybe things are much further out of hand than I'm telling you on this program, and things are getting really bad. But if you have any idea, during the week I'll try to write to the FBI and Mr. Webster and so forth and see what is going on. Now, Vernon Walters, just very quickly, San Francisco article, August 22nd, quotes, "Rightist dictators are no threat," UN Ambassador Walters said. That's the Vernon Walters that was responsible for the military coup in Brazil that the CIA did when right after John Kennedy was killed, a 22-year oppressive, just got rid of them last year, the military, and they're still hanging in there. He's the Vernon Walters that supported the Argentine junta. He's a Knight of Malta for the Vatican. The Vatican never has minded rightist dictators. But should he be the UN ambassador saying the United States doesn't see anything wrong with dictators, right-wing dictators? And he supported so heavily the Argentine junta that I just pulled out an article which I had on the air several years ago. This is from 1983, 3 years ago. Jack Anderson, about Argentine's plans, that the Argentine military junta before the Falkland War, while they were in power, and he was going back and forth, Vernon Walters was going back and forth there. They had ordered from Miami, Florida, $15 million crematorium to be built in Buenos Aires, and that they had a suspected 20,000 Argentine men, women, and children, at least 100 of them under the age of 10, had disappeared and been killed by the armed forces and the right-wing death squads. So they asked this company in Miami, they signed a deal in 1981 to get moderate, efficient crematorium that burns 400 people at a time. And the reason they wanted them was that the army and bulldozers scooped up, this is Jack Anderson, mass graves. They had unmarked these huge graves, and they wanted to get away with these people because they were decomposing, and they would put them into the new crematorium. The Navy dumped its victims, both living and dead, from helicopters over the ocean. Macabre jokes about flying nuns because two French nuns died this way. The Navy referred to the victims as comida para los pescados, fish food. Such victims were tossed to the side of Navy vessels. One young water skier went down under the water and saw vehicles holding down heads and dozens of weighted heads in the river bottom sent there right off of a military base. So out of Miami, and we can't blame those countries overseas for their fascism. From Miami comes the crematorium. From Philadelphia, you're shipping heads and parts. And we don't even know who they belong to. They don't have to tell you. The police says there's nothing to it. And the FBI says, well, we don't see anything that's popping up. Well, it's not going to be those heads that pop up. Now, I've gotten many, many letters from you, copies. I asked you, said that you wrote to William Rehnquist about the Rehnquist appointment to the Supreme Court. I really appreciate the letters that you sent. I sent a package of mail to the senators. It's hard to know with 100 senators how they're going to vote, because 50 always vote one way and 50 the other, and George Bush always has the deciding one that pushes it, the party line. But I thought maybe for some of them I'd put a personal letter, and as well as a package of material for many of them that I have had on the broadcast about why William Rehnquist can't recall things, that probably his mind has been washed or erased under the care of Dr. Carey. And I listed some of the items that I had on this broadcast. and you're familiar with them. I did write one personal letter to Senator Jake Garn from Utah, because you know how Jake Garn is going to vote, you know, right down the board. So what's the sense of wasting a letter to him? But I wrote it anyway, and this is what I wrote. Dear Senator Garn, I know your vote already regarding William Rehnquist, so why do I write to you? Talk about party line. You never do digress. Whatever your party does, right or wrong, you vote in favor of that particular decision that Ronald Reagan wants and that you all agree upon. However, you are a nice guy. I was touched by your offering your kidney to your daughter. She seems to be in a life-threatening situation with her kidney, and he has had the test, and he's offered to have surgery and give his kidney. That tells a lot about you. I am the mother of five children. We all want to see our children live and remain healthy. Unfortunately, I didn't have a choice in the matter. My 14-year-old daughter, Bonnie, was killed in a car crash when she was only starting her life. The Watergate dirty trickers that I write about in my letter to you regarding William Rehnquist's appointment as Chief Justice played a part in that crash that killed my daughter. Donald Segretti was stationed at Fort Ord, and I could tell you more if you're interested. A Mr. Garcia, a soldier at Fort Ord, left. He was in the car involved in the crash, left right after the accident, and went to your home state in Utah. He was never interviewed. He wasn't held by his officers. He was never questioned. He was told, get out of town, and he was released from the military at Fort Ord. So you will vote yes for William Rehnquist, and you will also try to save your daughter's life. And I will know that no matter what these appointments mean, whatever their links to the events of Watergate, promotions continue, and the CIA keeps covering up the bodies. A Mr. Lockwood in Carmel, California, was killed last week in a plane crash in Alaska. When we moved from our former house, the telephone company told me that Bonnie's calls and messages went to Mr. Lockwood's home on Kenyatta Drive, one block away. Sincerely, Mae Brussel. And the article I'm referring to, and it was a large article in the San Jose Mercury, Tragic End to Alaskan Odyssey of Pilot and Friends. It has to do with Glenn Lockwood, 63 years old, who has a manufacturing company in Sand City out here right past Pacific Grove over in Seaside. He was a mechanical engineer, a graduate of California Institute of Technology in Pasadena. He founded the LTI Corporation in a small wooden former church in Sand City. The company pioneered the development and application equipment of hot glue. He was killed in his plane, three people in the plane, and crashed. I never did see him. I never talked to him about it. The telephone company, as I say, he was a 14-year-old young child, almost a child, not a woman yet, who has her own phone, and these phone calls are connected one block away to the house of Glenn Lockwood. So I put that in my letter to Jake Garn. I know how he'll vote, but I just wanted to know what I think of the Watergators. Regarding the hijacking in Pakistan and the deaths and all those things that happened, there was a picture of a gentleman grieving in the San Francisco Examiner, and he's crying for his friend, and there are big black letters that said, they just took away a person who never did anything wrong in his life. Well, the way the world is moving, I've studied this for 23 years. I've been on the planet much longer, but studying seriously for 23 years, and it isn't enough to not do anything wrong. You got to start doing something right. Just to do nothing wrong, to be nice to yourself, your family, to be good to the people around you. If you don't look around you now and look at the headlines in the papers, if you can't figure out now what's going on, you're getting into pretty deep trouble, because it's all moving so very fast. And I'm not just being scary like these books of the late great planet and all that. I'm just citing the events as they're coming down and trying to make some sense of them. And nothing does make sense of them except that it smells like fascism. Now, on KFJC last week, that's a station up in up north near San Jose, David Emery plays my broadcast, World Watchers, twice a week up there, and he puts them on KFJC also. Los Altos Hills is where it is. And last week, somebody called him and asked him for the best source of a book on the Korean Airline, because this new book came out of Seymour Hersh. There was an article in Atlantic Monthly, and the book's coming out, and they wanted information about, this man wanted information about the best source. And David Emery suggested a book that by Mr. Johnson called Shoot Down. Well, there are three books on the Korean Airline and four counting Seymour Hersh's. I'll analyze all of them with you. I have all three except Hersh's. But no, that is not the best source. The best source of the Korean airline, which is available, I have reprints if you want, is my article, and I'm just saying this. I don't have to be modest about it. I wrote it for Hustler magazine, and I think it is the most definitive article that anybody has approached on the Korean airline. The title was, Who Killed Congressman Larry McDonald? Plenty of people wanted to blow this right-wing fanatic out of the sky, but Ronald Reagan may be holding the smoking gun. That was Hustler in February 84. I have reprints, and if you send me a self-addressed stamped envelope, I'll let you know how much it is to copy it, and or call me, and I'll let you know before you send it. This is a very clear, definitive article, not on the trajectory of the plane, not whether the right wing went down 10 degrees, not whether they were passing over installations. This is a very clear, concise article that goes right to the White House, just as the Challenger explosion goes directly to the seven calls to the White House that they have concealed. This president gets away with so much that I have to feel that people have to share some responsibility for the things that are happening right in front of their eyes. It used to be that it was magic or covert. There are no tricks anymore. There's a lot of material. What we're lacking are the guts to just do anything about it. And I also designed for the Hustler magazine. It was a round circle called the Larry McDonald Pie, and it had the sections of people that connected to Larry McDonald that were very important, and the necessity for him to be on a plane that would go down simultaneously as a coup for the Cold War, a strike for the Cold War. Now, you may ask, those of you who don't remember the incidents, why I would write for Hustler magazine. A lot of people were mad about that or disgusted or couldn't figure out why Mae Brussel wrote for Hustler. When I read that Larry McDonald went down, when I saw it on the television, I was up in Vancouver at the time, and I was coming to L.A. the next day, and I called Hustler magazine and wanted to talk to Larry Flynt because I explained to him on the telephone, I'd never met him, that if he wanted a story on Larry McDonald, I'd be glad to write it because the man who went down on that airplane had been behind the shooting and worked with the people who had paralyzed Larry Flynt. And I thought that maybe he would want an article linking his paralysis and the shootout that took place at the time he was left paralyzed with this event of Larry McDonald. And he really appreciated it. He smoked out this Joseph Franklin, who later, within a year of the time that I did this story, admitted in the courts that he did, in fact, shoot, was responsible for shooting Larry Flynt. But incidentally, that Franklin is in jail for bombing in black children in school in Tennessee and for killing a white and black person in Salt Lake City, and another one couple in Ohio, and he shot at Vernon Jordan because he was a white woman. He was never prosecuted on that, and he's not going to trial on the Larry Flynt shooting because if they take him down to Georgia, the jailers will open the door and let him out, and he'll flee the country and so that they can't even prosecute him. So I'll go over a lot of the material of the other books on the KAL and what happened to the KAL. The one, the black box, is the best one of the three that I have so far. And this goes into the fact that there was a lot of confusion over whether there was they didn't know it was a passenger civilian plane or the spy plane, the RC-135. But this one book, the black box, goes on to say that whatever had happened, you know, the destruction of the plane, this book is by Alexander Dallin. He says that whatever happened, dispatching this plane over the Soviet territory, it didn't have to be smart or well thought out decision. Because despite the destruction of the aircraft and all of its passengers and crew, the flight was almost surely a virtual unique intelligence bonanza for the United States. See, having all those people die, and that's why it's so important to think the way these people analyze us as being expendable, it was a great treat for the Cold War, and it enabled the president to start deploying weapons overseas and getting money for weapons he never thought he would get. And this book, The Black Box, talks about the U.S. Space Shuttle Challenger, the late great Challenger, and the alleged electronic monitoring that night. That Challenger, remember the broadcast I did, left at midnight from down at Cape Canaveral and was circling over the area where Larry McDonald was sitting in his little airplane and sinking into the ocean. Now, I'm going to do the rest of this program on matters related to Cameroon and the state of the mind of the Defense Department as they do these things to us. And it's just unbelievable how much is happening. I just want to cite the introduction to a book that somebody brought me at the station here called The Ominous Parallels, The End of Freedom in America by Leonard Peikoff. And it was published by Stein and Day, and interestingly enough, an introduction by Ayn Rand. And it begins with a theory written by a man in 1933. He spelled it all out earlier. Actually, it was a speech much earlier, telling his program for a country called Germany. He wasn't bashful about that, and he let everybody know his plans for the future. And the man speaking was Adolf Hitler. And very early in his political life, he gave a speech that was heard by many people and reprinted. He said, "It is necessary that the individual should finally come to realize that his own ego is of no importance in comparison with the existence of his nation." Now, this may sound familiar to you because Dr. Jose Delgado of the CIA and Navy Intelligence, who came over here from Europe and worked between Yale University and Madrid, has the same thinking, and I've had the same quotation. I'll share that with you. But that was our CIA in the 1950s, and this is Adolf Hitler in the 30s, that our ego has no importance in comparison with the existence of his nation, that the position of the individual ego is conditioned solely by the interests of the nation as a whole, that above all, the unity of a nation, spirit, and will are worth far more than the freedom of the spirit and the will of the individual, the unity of a nation. This state of mind, which subordinates the interests or ego to the conservation of the community, is really the first premise for every truly human culture, Hitler said. The basic attitude from which such activities arise, we call, to distinguish it from egoism or selfishness, is idealism. By this, we understand the individual's capacity to make sacrifices for the community, for his fellow men. These statements were made by Adolf Hitler, and this was the backbone of his moral philosophy. He didn't look sinister. The gas chambers that he built didn't look sinister either. The adjoining crematorium were not unruly places to live. The lawns were well kept, this book says. The flower borders. The sign at the entrance had a sign, baths. The unsuspecting Jews were simply going to take baths for delousing, which is typical to camps. There was light music, young ladies, pretty girls dressed in white blouses and navy skirts. They played happy music, The Merry Widow, The Tales of Hoffman, gay tunes, nothing solemn and somber from Beethoven. The death marches at Auschwitz were sprightly, merry tunes straight out of the Viennese and Parisian operetta. So, to such music, recalling as it did happier and more frivolous time, men, women, and children were led to bathhouses to undress, to prepare for a shower, some given towels. The rooms held 2,000 of them at a time. They were packed into a chamber like sardines, and then the massive doors were hermetically sealed, whereupon they added the crystals and the hydrogen cyanide and began the process under a signal to begin to kill them, and the executioner would laugh, "All right, give them something to chew on." Through the portholes, they would watch the people naked, breathing. The showers, they looked up, there was no water. The floors, they looked down, there was no drains. And it took moments for the gas to have effect. And suddenly they stampeded to the doors. There was clammy blood, spattered pyramid, clawing and mauling each other even to death. And the Nazis were not a tribe of prehistoric savages. And I'm thinking of the people you see around you or the potential today. And you have to think about this very carefully. They were part of a government that was using official legal acts and policies of modern Germany. The educated, industrialized, civilized Western European nation, renowned throughout the world for its intellectual and cultural achievements. The German university students were among the earliest groups to back Adolf Hitler. The intellectuals were his regime's most ardent supporters. The professors were distinguished academic credentials. They turned out volumes of admiring references. The Nazis didn't gain power against the wishes of the people. The people voted the Nazis in, knowing what he was going to offer. We'll take a one-minute break, and then I will continue with this part of the introduction again to Cameroon and the insanity that's taking place and how we're ignoring it.